Anchored is a production of the Classic Learning Test based in Annapolis, Maryland, reconnecting knowledge and virtue. Visit us at cltexam.com. Welcome and thank you for joining us at the CLT offices. We're really excited today because we have Professor Robert P. George as our first guest on our debut podcast. I'd like to take a little bit of time now to discuss what Anchored is. This program is a place where our CEO, Jeremy Tate, will engage in conversations with leading scholars, educators, and policy experts on issues at the intersection of education and culture. Additionally, we'll be highlighting big news in the world of education. As always, we love to get feedback, so please comment and review on this episode and all other episodes. We look forward to you joining us weekly. And without further ado, let's get started.
Robert P. George, I believe, is the single most influential conservative academic in the United States. Professor George is McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence and Director of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton University. In addition to his academic service, Professor George has served as chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Professor George is author of more than a dozen books, including What is Marriage and Conscience and Its Enemies, Confronting the Dogmas of Liberal Secularism. A graduate of Swarthmore College, Professor George holds degrees from Harvard University and Oxford University, the University of Dallas, and the American Enterprise Institute, AEI, jointly sponsor a Washington, D.C.-based program entitled the Robert P. George Initiative in Faith, Ethics, and Public Policy. Dr. George is also an accomplished banjo player. During the early days of COVID, I know I, for one, look forward to his daily banjo playing videos. Thanks so much for being here. And thank you as well. 3 or 4 years ago, when CLT was fresh out of the gate, you really put us on the map. I got to sit down with you in Pittsburgh, where you were the keynote speaker for the Association of Classical Christian Schools. And you gave us your endorsement. You said, I warmly commend CLT for giving colleges and universities the option of a standardized examination that eschews ideology and impartially tests knowledge and reasoning ability. When we got your endorsement, we were off to the races. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, congratulations on what you're doing. It's very important, and I'm glad to put whatever little influence I have behind it.
Dr. George was slated to be the keynote speaker for the CLT Higher Ed Summit this fall. Because of COVID, it has been postponed to the spring, but please bring the banjo with you when you come.
You never have to ask me twice to play the banjo. So yes, I'll bring it with me.
So Dr. George, in a minute, I'm going to ask you to expand on a recent tweet. But I'm wondering, maybe before that, if you could talk for a couple minutes about social media in general, Twitter in particular. I know a number of conservative intellectuals, even college presidents, that do not even have a Twitter account. But should they? What do you recommend?
Well, some conservatives believe that that Twitter and Facebook and other social media are the tool of the devil. Part of that's just being conservative, I suppose, and we don't much like new things. As Carson the not Carson the Butler, one of the other Butler characters on Downton Abbey said, "I detest change," and a lot of times conservatives are like that. There's also the problem with these big media platforms being very biased in the liberal direction, pretending to be mere platforms for the expression of free speech, but discriminating against conservatives. And that's turned a lot of conservatives against social media. Now, I myself believe social media is here to stay, and people are going to be using it. People of all generations are going to be using it. It's a way of communicating, a critical way of communicating with people today. So I think we need to be present there. That's the field of battle, whether we like it or not. So I'm very active, as you know, on Twitter. My Twitter handle there is @McCormickProfessor. And I'm active on Facebook as well. I have a public figure account and I have a personal account. I'd welcome many more followers on my personal account, but I'm at the 5,000 follower limit, or 5,000 friend, I guess you call them on Facebook, friend limit. And until Facebook expands that, I just have to pull people off the waiting list whenever a slot opens. But I'm happy to include as many people as possible on Facebook. And of course, anybody can look up a Twitter account or follow you on Twitter. So, I'm in this. I'm in with social media. I think it's a good way to communicate. I've had some great discussions, especially on Facebook. It's a little harder on Twitter because of the character limitation, the number of characters that you can type in a message. But even on Twitter, I've had some really interesting and I think valuable and fruitful exchanges with people, and more on Facebook. So, I'm, as I say, in on this, in with social media. I'm happy to do it. Let's take it and run with it.
Well, I think you're setting a great example there. And if you're not already, the account is at McCormick. It took me a few minutes to find what your account was because your handle is not your name. And again, it's at McCormick. Put
No, it's at McCormick Prof.
at McCormick Prof. That's right.
Yeah, MC capital CORMICKPROF at McCormick Prof. That refers to my Princeton chair, McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence at Princeton.
That's right. That's right. And if you have a Twitter account, put Dr. George on the little bell, and that way you get a notification when he tweets something. What he says, I think, is really important, and there's not enough intellectual conservatives that are utilizing the platform, in my opinion. So Dr. George, thank you for being bold there as well. You don't, you're not bashful. You speak the truth in love. It's a great example for sure. So thank you. So one tweet in particular. This is August 13th, and this is a thread that you started. Some thoughts from 35 years of teaching 18 to 22-year-olds and meeting students as I give lectures around the country. One, young people are more capable than we think. We tend to underestimate rather than overestimate their ability to grapple with intellectual challenges. Two, many bright young men and women don't know things we tend to assume they know. I want to stop there. Can you expand on that? They don't know things we tend to assume they know. What are you referring to here?
Well, I'm talking about history, I'm talking about culture, I'm talking about religion, I'm talking about the history of science. In so many areas, we find young people who are very intellectually gifted, very smart. I mean, I teach students at Princeton. They're all class valedictorians. They have nearly perfect SATs. Many of them have perfect SAT scores. They are really smart kids. I'm sometimes surprised, as my colleagues are, at things that they just haven't been taught in school. Things that they don't know. I once referred in one of my classes to the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments from the Bible, the Decalogue, and I noticed blank stares from many of my students. They didn't know what that meant. There used to be a common fund of knowledge, at least for decently educated people. You could assume that they knew certain things, biblical references, for example, facts about American history, including American military history, political history, cultural history, the facts about the history of science, as I say, even a bit about philosophy. Today you can't count on that. Just because a student is really smart doesn't mean that they know much of anything. Now, that's not their fault, as I said in the tweet. I mean, if students don't know things, who's responsible for that? Well, we are. It's the grown-ups. It's people, parents and teachers and pastors and people who should have been providing these students with a much better education than we have provided them with. Part of the problem, I think, is that there's been an abandonment and something of a giving up on the idea of general knowledge or liberal education. Education has been instrumentalized. We see this now infecting university life as well. Parents are pressuring students, and sometimes students themselves or just desire to have purely technical preparatory educations, preparing for careers, vocational educations, even at historic liberal arts institutions like Princeton or Swarthmore or Oberlin or Pomona or Stanford. I don't think this is at all a good thing. Yes, by all means, if you want to train for a career, train for a career, get the best training you can for your career. But I'd like everybody to also have the benefit of a liberal education. Even if they don't go to college, they should have the benefit of a liberal education afforded to them in high school. And we're failing. We're letting the side down there. So we don't stretch our students enough. We don't give them enough credit for how bright they are. We tend to underestimate what they're capable of intellectually. But we sometimes tend to overestimate the scope and depth of their knowledge. We assume they know certain things that, in fact, they don't know. They don't know because nobody's told them.
So this, Dr. George, I think the most shocking education statistic I've seen, this is from an NBC poll. So the older generation, those that are 65 and older, 74% can pass the U.S. citizenship test. The number of those that can pass under 45 is shocking. It's 19%. And that's also the most educated demographic in terms of formal schooling. Is there a connection there at all with the current civil unrest?
Yeah, there is. Some of the problem is ideological. My students, when they first enter my classroom, say in constitutional interpretation, one of the courses I teach, or civil liberties, come in tending to believe, not 100%, but a majority come in believing that there is something they describe as a hate speech exception to the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which of course guarantees our right to freedom of speech. There is no hate speech exception. It doesn't exist. You can get out the most powerful microscope or magnifying glass and you can look for it and you won't find the hate speech exception, nor will you find it in our jurisprudence. The courts haven't even purported to find a hate speech exception. Yeah. And students are flabbergasted when I inform them that actually there is no hate speech exception. But they're sure that it's there because somehow they picked this up out of the out of the media and the general culture, which I think is the product of a kind of ideological skewing. People want to suppose that there's something called a hate speech exception to freedom of speech, and so they push the idea that it's actually in there, but it's not. It's like a unicorn. It doesn't exist.
Yeah. So let's continue with this tweet thread. You do say it isn't their fault. It's an indictment of our education system and culture, but it is reality. So don't assume that they know, and certainly don't revile or ridicule them for not knowing. Teach them. Third point, young people are not, as is widely supposed, natural rebels. They are, like most humans, natural conformists. They tend to believe what they think they're supposed to believe. Our job is to prompt them to question their beliefs, open their minds, think for themselves. You know, Dr. George, when I first saw that thread, I thought, you know, in the 60s or 70s, a liberal would have been tweeting this, and here you are as a leading intellectual conservative in America saying, let's open their minds.
That's because I believe in liberal education. I'm a political conservative, even you might say a traditionalist, but I believe in liberal education in part because I'm a conservative and a traditionalist. I believe that broad education, deep education, general education is part of the essence of our humanity. It elevates us as human beings. It's intrinsically part of our flourishing as mm-hmm. as human beings. So if the liberals in the old days were for liberal education, then bully for them, good for them. I salute them. If some conservatives weren't enthusiastic enough about liberal education, challenging students, opening their minds, then that's a little blot on the conservative past, but let's get past that. I think liberals and conservatives ought to be able to agree that part of our mission as academics is to open our students' minds. I put it this way. This is the motto of the James Madison program at Princeton, which I founded and continue to have the honor to direct. Our motto is think deeply, think critically, and think for yourself. And that's what professors need to be doing, teaching students to think deeply, think critically, and think independently. It's not our job. It's not my job. It's not my job as a conservative. It's not a colleague's job as a liberal to tell our students what to think. That's indoctrination. That's not education. It's the opposite of education. It's antithetical to education. Our job is to help our students to think, teach them how to think more deeply, more critically, and for themselves. Now, as I say, young people, like most human beings, are not rebels. They're not natural rebels. They have an undeserved reputation for being natural rebels. I've been teaching them for 35 years. I can tell you this with certainty. Yep. And if you want to test this, if you want to test the question of whether they're natural rebels or natural conformists, just do the little thought experiment when you think of a 16 or 17-year-old kid suddenly discovering that he's gone out and he's wearing the wrong sneakers. They're not the ones that are in fashion. The wrong Nikes. It is so not true. The right look. Okay? So our job is to open them up, challenge what they think. disrupt their tendency to think along with the crowd, to go along with what they're expected to think. Mm-hmm. Our message to our students, we as professors, people in high schools who teach us, high school teachers, our message needs to be, you cannot outsource your thinking. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed. We're not going to permit that. You know, you've got to do it. There's some things you have to go to. You got to go to the bathroom for yourself. Nobody can do that for you. Right? You got to digest your food for yourself. Nobody can do that for you. Same with your thinking. You've got to think for yourself. You can't outsource it. Nobody can do it for you. Now, I don't care whether the student comes in to my classroom as a committed conservative mm-hmm. or a committed liberal, whether he is deeply religious or deeply secular. I want that student to think about why he thinks what he thinks, to question whether he's got good reasons for thinking what he thinks. Did he just happen into these views? Did he pick them up from the ambient culture? Was he indoctrinated into believing them? Why does he believe them? Think it through. Think about whether you ought to revise your beliefs. And believe me, if you've been in any of my classes, you'd know this. Well, under assault might be a bit too rough, but you're going to be challenged by me, no matter how much you agree with me. In fact, if I pick up that you're a conservative and a Christian and you agree with me, you're probably going to get a rougher time. Okay. I'm going to challenge you to make sure that you're thinking for yourself, that you're not outsourcing your thinking to anybody, including me.
Yeah. Love that. We want to hear about this new initiative, this new lecture series, E Pluribus Unum, the sources of unity as part of the new Robert P. George Initiative on Faith, Ethics, and Public Policy.
Well, I'm very excited about it, and it's great to be working with my friends at the University of Dallas and the American Enterprise Institute. The initiative began 3 years ago at Baylor University. Baylor was the initial sponsor. It was proposed by the then dean of Baylor, Thomas Hibbs, and we've had 3 years of programming in Washington, D.C., where we have as our audience members of Congress, people from the administration, people who work in the various activist and advocacy organizations in Washington, D.C., lawyers, other professionals, who come to our panel discussions and lectures in order to think deeply about big picture questions, not just the nuts and bolts of policy, but the big, deep philosophical questions, the perennial questions about justice and the common good and human rights and human dignity. And it's been a very successful run. Dean Hibbs is now President Hibbs. He's moved from the University of Dallas to the University of Dallas, where he's now president. He's a very distinguished philosopher himself, by the way. Mm-hmm. And so the initiative has moved with him, and it's now being sponsored by the University of Dallas. And he has brought in as a co-sponsor the American Enterprise Institute, which is, of course, right there in Washington, D.C. Their headquarters is in Washington, D.C. It's led by a wonderful person, a deep thinker himself, Robert Doerr. We're working then with a very dear friend of mine who's the point person at AEI, Yuval Levin, wonderful scholar, wonderful intellectual, young and very powerful and compelling thinker. And so we're now starting our next round. This will be the first set of the first bit of programming we've done since moving from Baylor to the University of Dallas and AEI. And so we decided that our theme for this year, given the deep polarization in the country and the trouble that we're experiencing in the streets and in Congress and the difficulty people seem to have getting along, that we're going to make the theme our national motto. E pluribus unum. Out of many are made one. Out of many we are one. And we'll focus on, as the subtitle says, the sources of our unity. What are the sources of American unity? Now, we know that what makes Americans Americans, what unites us, is not a common race. We have many different races, or ancestry, or ethnicity, or nationality. We come from Japan and Italy and the Ukraine and Ghana and India and Turkey and from all over the world. America has been a melting pot, and Americans have come from everywhere. My own ancestors came from Italy and on the one side, and from Syria on the other side. My wife's ancestors are Jewish people from Eastern Europe and from Russia. I grew up in West Virginia around people who were descended from the Scots-Irish and from the English. We're very diverse ethnically, racially. We have many different religions, so religion can't be the basis of our unity. We're Protestants, Catholics, Christians, Jews, Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, unbelievers. We're of every religious description you can find. So if it's not race or ethnicity or blood and soil or throne and altar, what is it? Is there anything that binds us together? Yes. It's our fundamental understanding of human dignity, human rights, the common good, and the importance of republican democracy. We're bound together by the principles of the Declaration of Independence as effectuated by the institutions of the Constitution. Those are the sources of our unity, and so we're going to put the focus there. Now, those great principles did not just come out of thin air in the late 18th century. Madison and the other founding fathers and architects of the Constitution did not just dream them up out of their heads. They are themselves, as Jefferson said, deeply rooted in a broader tradition, the traditions of Athens and Jerusalem, mm-hmm. of Greek and Roman philosophy and jurisprudence and Hebrew revelation. So we have to understand, if we're to understand the sources of our unity, not just the sort of Enlightenment sources, as they're sometimes called, or the American founders, but the deeper streams of thought and of faith that formed the American founders and informed the American founding. Our very first event will feature someone who's not an American at all, but knows a great deal about the broad tradition, especially the biblical tradition that helped to feed the American founding. And that is the great British public intellectual and religious leader, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. Rabbi Sacks will be in a conversation with Yuval Levin and with me, where we'll be talking about his new book, Morality, and his biblically informed understanding of the common good. So there's going to be our launch, and then we're going to be talking with a lot of other interesting people at events over the course of the next year under that theme, E Pluribus Unum.
Dr. George, that's great. I'm currently reading one of Jefferson's many biographies, and I've thought about you as I've been reading, and I'm reading Meacham's Art of Power, and the level of his productivity. One of the great quotes in there is that, you know, those who heard Jefferson talk about architecture thought he was a builder. Those who heard him talk about medicine thought he was a doctor. Who heard him talk about law thought he was a lawyer. I think that your similar is such an incredible generalist of knowledge as well. I'm wondering, with your hands in so many initiatives, do you find much time for just leisure reading on your own? And if so, what are you reading?
Well, I do find a bit of time. I wish I had more. I used to have more time when I was traveling because I could read on planes and on trains and sort of when I was away from the ordinary demands on my life. But I notice now I spend all my time on Zoom, so I don't have a lot of time for reading. I'm reading less than I was before COVID-19, ironically. You would think I would be at home and I'd have more time for reading. It's quite the opposite. Basically, it's my bedtime reading and whenever I can grab a half hour. Yeah. Or 45 minutes. Right at the moment, I'm reading Rabbi Jonathan Sacks' new book, Morality, in part for preparation for our event in the initiative, but also just because I read everything Jonathan Sacks reads because he's got so much to teach all of us. He's a true teacher of humanity. I have on my agenda to read a new biography of Lincoln, especially it's a treatment of Lincoln in relationship with the American founders, Lincoln's understanding of the American founders and the way they informed his work, by the great Washington and Lee political scientist Lucas Morrow. So I've got a stack of things waiting for me, and I can't wait to get through it.
That's great. Dr. George, what single text has influenced you the most and why? If there's just one work that our listeners need to just start reading today, what is it?
Well, that's the easiest question you've asked me or anyone has ever asked me, because I know what the text is that was most transformative to me in my own life. It was Plato's dialogue, Gorgias. I encountered it when I was a sophomore, I believe, in college at Swarthmore. I was taking an ordinary, perfectly good, but not a special, not special, introductory political theory course at a good professor. He assigned readings from the history of philosophy, from the ancient to the modern, political philosophy. And pretty early in the course, we read this dialogue. It was the first dialogue of Plato's I'd ever read, Gorgias, and it was absolutely transformative. It taught me something that I should have known, but didn't know. I was one of those kids who was ignorant. Nobody had told me. I tended to think that the purpose of knowledge and education was instrumental. You want to know things so you can do things with the knowledge. You want to get a good education so that you can get a good job, have a good income, have high social status, all perfectly legitimate things to want, legitimate aspirations. What Plato taught me in that dialogue, and what he will teach anybody who reads that dialogue, is that there's something even more fundamental than the instrumental knowledge, instrumental value of knowledge, and that's its intrinsic value. That we should want knowledge not just for what it can get us. Even more fundamentally, we should want it for what it makes us, for its intrinsic enrichments. We human beings are naturally fulfilled by our knowing, the activity of knowing. Knowing isn't just passively taking in information. It's thinking, it's understanding, it's an activity. And in that activity of knowing, we find a fundamental aspect of our well-being and fulfillment. If we treat knowledge and education as purely instrumental, we're going to be missing something profoundly important about what it means to be a human being. Well, once I read the dialogue, the light bulb went on over my head, and I could suddenly see what I had at best perceived only very, very dimly. The analogy of Plato's cave might be relevant here. I'd just seen it sort of in a very shadowy way if I had seen it at all. And suddenly now it's very clear. And it set me, I say it's the most influential work in my own life of any that I've read. It set me on the path that I have pursued, my vocation as a scholar and a teacher, someone dedicated to the pursuit of knowledge. Pursuit of truth.
So apart from this, perhaps know Robbie George as we know you.
I'm sorry?
I said apart from this encounter with Plato, maybe know Robbie George as we know and appreciate you today. Would that be?
Oh yeah, that's for sure. Who knows what sort of monster. I'd be even worse than I am now. I think it was Waugh, Evelyn Waugh, who was said, How can you be a Christian, a Catholic, when you're such a bad person? Uh-huh. And Waugh said, Madam, if I were not a Christian and a Catholic, I would be a very much worse person.
Uh-huh. I love that. You know, this wholesale buy-in into utilitarian view of education. My last couple of years in the public school arena, I would ask students the first day, they must have thought I was crazy. I would just say, why are we here? Like, what is the point? And they would all say that it was to get a better job. I mean, 99% would say it's to get a better job. And then I would turn around and write on the chalkboard, the object of education is to learn to love what is beautiful, Plato. And they didn't, the total cognitive dissonance. Like, they couldn't even probably, like, what is he talking about? I love that you're raising awareness to this. Super important stuff.
Cornel West, with whom I have the pleasure of teaching, and we lecture around the country and we write together, has a very dramatic way of putting this, and he's absolutely right. And here he too is appealing to the Greeks. He says the point of an education, the point of a liberal arts education, is to learn how to die. In other words, to learn what matters in life, what's fundamentally important. And it's not income and wealth and power and influence and prestige and status. It's faith and it's family and it's honor and truth and honesty and dignity and integrity. You learn how to die in order to learn how to live, so you'll get your priorities right. It's absolutely right.
So Cornel West, and you've been a model for civil dialogue in the United States at a time where people can't seem to be in the same room with people who disagree with them. How did that relationship come about? How long has this been?
Well, Cornel and I have known each other, oh gosh, I want to say for almost 30 years. Wow. But we only became friends. We only became anything more than acquaintances about 17 years ago. We had been before that in some faculty seminars together. We had seen each other in action in those seminars. We'd interacted a little with lots of other people in those seminars. They're very fruitful, very good seminars. But we didn't really know each other. Then in 2006, I guess, a student of both of ours, a young man named Andrew Perlmutter, very good student, who's a religion major. He'd studied with Cornell. He'd studied with me, took our courses. Came to my office one day and said that he and some of his friends at Princeton had raised a lot of money, and they were creating a magazine, a new campus magazine of culture and arts and politics. These Princeton kids do stuff like this. They wanted to launch this magazine, and as a regular feature of the magazine, they wanted to have an interview of one professor by another professor, and they wanted to start that with the very first issue. And he said they'd ask Professor Cornell West to be the interviewer and let him nominate whoever he would like to be his interviewee, his interview subject. And he had indicated to them that he would like to interview me. So Andrew had come along to ask whether I would be willing to be interviewed by Professor West. And I was very honored that Cornell, who was already then, even then, I mean, a major public intellectual, very, very, one of the most well-known faculty members at Princeton, I was very flattered that Cornell wanted to interview me. And so, of course, I said yes. Well, the day came along, and I think the interview was scheduled for 2:00 in the afternoon. It was supposed to go for an hour. The tape ran out after an hour, but we just couldn't stop. We were arguing and talking about every issue you can imagine and every public policy question and arguing about Kierkegaard and St. Thomas Aquinas and just going at it. So yeah. After 4 hours, I looked at my watch and I said, my goodness, Cornell, it's 6:00. My wife's going to be wondering what happened to me. I need to get home for dinner. And he said, oh, well, this has been such a wonderful opportunity to get together, get to know each other, Brother Robbie. We really have to get to know each other better. And I said, well, walk me down. My car's parked down here on William Street. Walk me down to my car. We can chat along here as we go. So then we got to my car, and I stood there for another half hour with my hand on the latch because we couldn't let go of the conversation. And finally, at 6:40 or so, I said, Cornell, I'm really going to have to go. And then I think it was really within a week or so of that happening, some of the senior members of the faculty, some of the better known faculty members on the campus, got a note from the dean of the college, who was in charge of the freshman seminar program, saying that she really wanted to encourage some senior members of the faculty, more senior members of the faculty, to teach these freshman seminars, that we didn't have enough support for these from the senior faculty members. The burden was really falling on junior faculty members and adjuncts, and we really want to try to expose our freshmen an opportunity to study with some of the more senior and better known members of the faculty. Well, again, the light bulb went off on over my head, and I thought, gosh, wouldn't it be great to just continue that conversation with Cornell in the context of a seminar where we teach the books that have been important to us in our own intellectual and spiritual odysseys, and we interact with each other, and you know, maybe he chooses six and I choose six. We do one book a week for our 12-week semester, and wouldn't that be a good thing? So I proposed it to Cornell. He immediately said yes. We launched the seminar from the ringing of the bell, from the moment we started talking, there was magic. You could just tell there was that chemistry. There was something about that. We knew from the, it wasn't even, we didn't take 10 minutes into the discussion for us to realize this is magical. So we continued teaching together until he left Princeton to go to Harvard, or back to Harvard where he had taught before. And even then, he's come back on one occasion when he had a leave of absence from Harvard, the sabbatical. He came back and we taught the seminar again. It's a real joy. It's a pleasure. We teach Plato and St. Augustine and all the way up through the Renaissance and the Reformation, Machiavelli, Luther and Erasmus, Locke and Hobbes and Rousseau, 19th century figures like John Stuart Mill and John Henry Newman, 20th century authors like John Dewey, C.S. Lewis, Martin Buber, Martin Luther King. It's just, it's a blast. And I've learned an enormous amount in interacting with Cornell, and he's kind enough to say he's learned a lot from our interactions as well. So it's great fun for us. The students seem to enjoy it. It's been a wonderful thing. And of course, we have been going around the country together, doing programs together, trying to model the kind of dialogue that we think the country needs. And we've been doing some writing together, including most recently a piece in the Boston Globe called Courage and Honesty.
The beauty of that relationship is born out of a common intellectual tradition. It's really what we're trying to get back to with the CLT, saying that if all of America can be fluent with the great books that really the intellectual tradition that gave birth to America, out of many one, we have common ground. I love that story, and I think it's evident of what we've been talking about. Dr. George, profoundly grateful to you. This has been a real honor to sit down and to hear about the good work you're doing.
Thank you,
keep it up. Very grateful.
I appreciate it. Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to our new podcast. Please subscribe. And if you enjoyed this episode, feel free to share it with friends and colleagues. Join us next week when we'll be visited by Dr. Thomas Hibbs, president of the University of Dallas. CLT, Reconnecting Knowledge and Virtue.